Okay, good afternoon again, everyone. Once again, thank you for dialing into our 2014 Annual Client Education Conference call. And we will start our presentation today with Bill Anderson. Bill, it's all yours.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you very much for calling us your trusted estates attorneys. We are very focused on long-term relationships with clients. One of the weaknesses of estate planning and estate settlement and estate litigation and asset protection and elder law, which is the only five things we do, is that it's a transaction. It's a one-time event. This is our approach, our process to make sure we stay connected with our clients. And every year we do this. And so we bring you up to speed on the things that happen. For many years, trust and estates was sort of the stoic thing. From the 1300s to the 1800s or 1900s, wills were what wills were. That's not true today. And there's so many moving parts in our sophisticated financial and other world that this is a very quickly changing area. So we hope you enjoy this. And again, thank you for letting us be of service. The first topic that I want to deal with today is for any of you that have IRAs, 401Ks, or the other qualified plans like 403Bs for nonprofits and hospitals and colleges or 457 plans, but pension plans, but anybody who has qualified money, and I'm going to refer to those as IRA, there has been some major changes in the law. On June the 12th of this year, the United States Supreme Court ruled unanimously that inherited IRAs are not asset protected, So what does that mean? Well, we know that your IRA is protected for you if you create it. When I say protected, I mean from lawsuits, creditors, divorcing spouses. No one's going to take your IRA from you. When you pass away, if you have left it to your spouse, it's called a rollover IRA. And it is protected totally for your spouse. That's one of the reasons that when you can, you want to roll a 401k over to an IRA because you get better asset protection and stretch. Now, so up until 8 years ago, if you asked any of my partners or the other attorneys on the phone today, before 8 years ago, was an IRA protected after it went down to the children or other beneficiaries? We would have said yes. About 8 years ago, cases started showing up in federal court, starting in Texas, that said otherwise. We were one of the first firms that worked with some of the top leading attorneys in the United States. And those top leading attorneys, we got together and we went to the IRS and they allowed us to create something called the IRA Inheritance Trust. Now, many of you on the phone, I suspect, have the IRA Inheritance Trust. You do the IRA Inheritance Trust because it is the recipient. It is the beneficiary of your IRA after you and your spouse have gone to sit on your cloud. You do it for one reason. You do it for the asset protection. If you don't care if your child loses or your loved one loses their IRA if they're sued, or you don't care if they are divorced and the divorcing spouse takes half of it, don't worry about this. I just don't find too many of our clients who, and I certainly don't feel that way. So what do? We create this. So the Supreme Court said you have to have this IRA inheritance trust for it to be protected. So this argument went along for the last 8 years until the Supreme Court's decision, and it was argued in the front pages of the Wall Street Journal and the like. We've been doing these trusts for 8 years. Now there is no question we were right. So the takeaway for you is if you care about that inheritance, you create the IRA inheritance trust. You make it the beneficiary of your IRA after you and your spouse are gone. And what are the benefits you get from that? Well, your child can still take the stretch out, meaning that they can stretch it out over their life expectancy. Divorce protection, protection for minors, lawsuits, creditors, bankruptcy, protection from losing government benefits, minimizing future estate taxes. And it's a very nice legacy. And many people today are leaving IRAs or pieces of IRAs to grandchildren because you get a much longer stretch. In doing that, this is a nice way to do it, where if you leave it to a grandchild, you can make your grandchild's parent, your child, the trustee until they're age 35. One last point, and we'll move on. And because this really is one of the biggest pieces of news to come out this year. And you say, well, what happens if my mom, my dad, they weren't on top of their estate planning, they didn't do this for me, they just left it as an inherited IRA, it's in my name now, or it's an inherited IRA name, can I put it in an IRA inheritance trust? The answer is no, but you can rectify it for the next generation. And by that I mean you can now, as long as you can name a beneficiary on your inherited IRA, you can name an IRA inheritance trust. And you can get all of the asset protection that I am talking about. The one difference will be is that you can only stretch an IRA once. And so if you do it for your children, your parents' grandchildren, they won't stretch it over their life expectancy, but they will get the asset protection. So the takeaway is, if you have more than $300,000 combined husband and wife and qualified money, you really, really need an IRA inheritance trust. It is our recommendation you have one if you care about protecting that wealth you're passing. So that was 10 minutes or 9 minutes, but it is a very important topic. For those of you who have our book, there's the Pocket Guide to Trust and Estates. There's a whole chapter in it. If you want one of our books, you can get it on Amazon and pay $19.95. There are over 10,000 copies sold. But if you're our client, you don't need to do that. Just call in and we'll send you one. From that, let's change the subject. I want to introduce you to Jolene Searles, who is one of my law partners. And many of you know Jolene. She is probably one of the brightest, if not the brightest attorneys I've ever met. She's the only person I know came within 2 points of maxing the law school admissions test many years ago when she took that, and she's going to talk to you about intergenerational planning. So, Jolene, take it away.
Thanks so much, Bill. I want you all to imagine, imagine an organization worth millions of dollars where the CEO and CFO refuse to share any financial information and guidance with their employees who they plan on taking over the business. In that case, it's extremely unlikely that the business would or even could continue after those executives are gone. We need to look at family succession planning and multi-generational planning the exact same way. Studies have shown us that it's not high taxes or poor investment advice that are responsible for the diminishment of wealth throughout the generations. It's the breakdown of trust and communication within the family. With about $40 million of wealth transferring to future generations by 2050, it's imperative that we work on resolving this problem immediately. So one of the main issues with this is that we've always seen inheritance and estate planning as an end-of-life event. When we picture somebody's estate, we imagine the family members all dressed in black, sitting around a table in the attorney's office, waiting for the will to be read. The problem is that by this time, it's too late to address any unresolved issues. And what often happens is the outcome includes family members being caught off guard, planning not working the way that we intended it to, people being caught by surprise, and just an overall mess. But when people include their children, their family members, other beneficiaries, and other important people in their plans from the start, families are generally going to be much happier with the outcome of the situation. So the problem with this is that death and money are not the easiest things for people to discuss with their loved ones. Both parents and kids have various reasons for that. For parents, they may feel it's not a pressing issue. They may be in denial about their mortality. They may worry about creating a sense of entitlement in their heirs. They may not want their kids to know what their wealth is. Some families just don't openly talk about financial issues. Some parents may not want their kids to count on the inheritance because they may decide they need it or they want to spend it. Some parents worry that their kids will start trying to govern the parents' spending. They worry that knowledge of the inheritance will ruin the kids' initiative to grow their own estates or to take responsibility for their own finances. On the flip side, kids may not feel it's appropriate to bring up their parents' money. They may be in denial about their parents' mortality. They may not want to look greedy. Whatever the reason is, it's really important to initiate these discussions right up front, and generally it's easier for the parents, and it should be the parents who really try to start these discussions. I want to give you all some statistics. Although about 83% of people have an estate plan in place, only 54% of those have discussed those plans with their kids, and only about 34% of people have informed their heirs of how much wealth they have. 85% of heirs who have no unresolved issues are going to be satisfied with their parents' estate plans and estate settlement, as compared to only 37% of those who had unresolved issues that hadn't been discussed. 89% of heirs who knew the inheritance details were satisfied with their parents' estate settlement, as opposed to only 65% of those who didn't. Although only 34% of people will admit that they wish their parents had done something differently, 72% of them say that they plan on doing things much differently than their parents did. Only about 42% of millennials have discussed their inheritance plans with their parents and know the amount of their parents' wealth. Only 31% of those know where the wealth is, and only 27% of those have seen their estate plan. So although we realize that this is a pressing issue, we see this being discussed much less now than it has been in the past. So it's really important for families to get involved with this and to discuss this with their kids and future generations. Today's wealth planning is more than just getting a will drawn up. It's planning for your retirement, long-term care planning, planning for death and disability, planning for taxes, planning for college for kids and for grandkids. Setting up different types of plans for kids and grandkids, involving gifting, assisting them with the purchase of a new home. So what can you do to ensure a smooth transition for your heirs? Well, first of all, good planning and good communication can solve all of these problems. So have a comprehensive financial plan, retirement plan, long-term care plan in place to make sure that you're provided for during your life, and then that's a smooth process if something happens to you. Make sure that you have a good estate plan in place and keep that up to date so that upon your death, that transition is a smooth transition. Keep good records of your assets. Either disclose to your children what your assets are and where they're located, or let them know where they can find that information in the event that something happens to you. For those of you who have done your estate planning with us, you're probably familiar with a tab that we have in your books called location lists. This is a great place for you to list out contact information for important people, locations of important documentation, and things that your family members will need in order to take care of you or take care of your estate. So I encourage all of you to fill that out. Look at ways to minimize taxes for heirs. This is estate taxes, inheritance taxes, income taxes, capital gains taxes, etc. Consolidate your assets so that your heirs aren't having to run all over the place to discover what things are, where they are, and to deal with 50 different financial institutions and advisors. Have those all as consolidated as possible because they're going to be going through enough. If something does happen to you, the last thing we want to do is add more to their plate. Have family meetings to sit down and educate your family members on financial matters, on your estate planning, to discuss responsibilities and duties upon the occurrence of those certain events. Proactively communicate to your children and to your heirs who's going to play what roles, who makes healthcare decisions, who makes financial decisions. Are there any unresolved issues? Who's going to get the house? What's going to happen with personal property? You'll see that personal property is one of the biggest reasons for arguments upon death. So if you can list that out, who gets my diamond ring, who gets my painting in the library, different things like that will really help to simplify these matters. Specify disposition of remains. Do you want to be buried, cremated? Any specific instructions for services? So any planning that you can do on the front end is really going to eliminate problems on the back end. And I just want you all to remember that all families govern themselves and reach decisions. The key difference for families whose wealth lasts and continues throughout the generations is that they do it by design. So that's all I have for you on multi-generational planning. I'm going to turn it over now to Jim Collins. Jim is Bill and I's other partner. He was the legal technical director of the National Network of Estate Planning Attorneys. We were lucky enough to steal him away. He still works with them and continues to assist them and keep them informed of important tax updates and estate planning information. And so he is going to give us all an update on our 2014 tax situations, some changes, some proposed changes, some really, really important stuff for all of us to know. So, Jim, I will go ahead and turn it over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jolene, and thank you, Bill and Jolene, for getting us off to a good start. Some years when we talk about tax changes that have happened or are pending, there are big things we're right in the midst of or that have happened. This year is more a year of the things that may well happen based on the rumblings and proposals that we stay up to date on. Bill mentioned the book we wrote when Jolene and Bill and I released our book in October of 2012. Of course, predictably, less than 3 months later, Congress massively changed the estate tax law, and we printed a second edition in 2013. The biggest thing, and I will return to this at the end when I am finished, but the biggest potential changes coming will affect those of you who are nearing or who are at or who are over those estate tax taxation thresholds, excuse me, if you were to pass away. So we know right now, each of you can exempt the first $5.34 million from estate tax. Think of that as a coupon that the IRS has given you. That coupon can be saved entirely and can be used at death to offset the first $5.34 million from estate tax, or part of it can be used with advanced planning, or even all of it under today's law with advanced planning during your lifetime. If you are married, husband and wife each have a $5.34 million coupon, and so that total is 10.68. Do not make the mistake if you're decently under that amount to just assume that you are fine. for two reasons. Growth could take you over those thresholds, and the law could change, and that's basically what we're talking about here. One of the biggest things kind of percolating out there is a combination of the president's fiscal year proposal, which our presidents always work on, so the 2015 fiscal year proposal, and then what is called the Green Book commonly. If you were to Google fiscal year 2015 revenue proposals, again, I'll give that to you, fiscal year 2015 revenue proposals, it would take you to a site at about a 300-page document that is commonly known as the Green Book. These are things that legislatures, the President, Congress, the Revenue Department are all considering changing in the future. So the first one has to do with this coupon amount. Just when we thought we had permanency in the estate tax law and it would stay at $5.34 million, and go up each year, indexed for inflation, it is being proposed that $5.34 million apiece would be lowered back to $3.5 million. Now, that would affect a lot of you. So this is basically a rollback to 2009 numbers, and President Obama's camp since 2008 has really been in love with this $3.5 million estate tax exemption amount. Also, once you're above that number, these proposals would raise the current estate tax rate on anything above that from the current 40% to 45%. So frankly, if we went back to a $3.5 million exemption amount and 45% tax, that would be what we had in 2009. The other change would be that this coupon I mentioned, worth $5.34 million currently, that could be reduced to $3.5 million, we would go back to 2009 again, wherein the law would only let you gift away or use up to $1 million of that during your lifetime. So be aware those changes could come, and we need to stay alert to that. The other major changes has to do with advanced planning that a lot of our clients do for either estate tax savings or asset protection or both. Some of you have heard about dynasty trust planning, our generation-skipping dynasty planning, where people legitimately shield assets from estate taxes and roll that benefit forward generation after generation after generation. In Florida currently, our dynasty trust provisions let us do that for about 10 generations or 360 years. It's being proposed that that would be limited across the country to no more than 90 years. And for a lot of you, you might think, why would I ever want to plan 90 years in the future? But this all has to do with leaving a dynastic legacy, and this may well be changed. The next thing is proposed changes to some of our favorite and most exponential and powerful advanced planning tools. Perhaps you've heard of a grantor retained annuity trust, or a GRATH by acronym, or an intentionally defective grantor trust. It doesn't matter whether you've heard of those or know about them, but it has been proposed for several years now, and eventually we will probably see either a complete elimination of these advanced planning tools, or we will see them be greatly, greatly limited. Another thing that the Green Book proposes and may well come to pass because of some of the wealthy Americans behind it is what has become popularly known as the Buffett Rule. Warren Buffett observed just a couple of years ago, he made the famous statement that I pay a lower tax rate than my secretary does. And that was legitimate, that was true. One of the richest men in the world at the end of the year, it was paying a lower tax rate than his secretary. And studies were done, for instance, in 2008, of the 400 highest income Americans, one of every three of them paid less than 15% income tax. And in 2009, 22,000 households who made more than $1 million income a year, 22,000 of those households paid less than 15% tax, and nearly 1,500 of them literally paid zero tax. So it is being proposed that no one making more than $1 million a year in income would pay less than 30% income tax, what is commonly known as a fair tax, and it is estimated that that would affect about 0.3% of all taxpayers. But that Buffett rule is something that may gain traction. And then the last couple of things is that there will likely be a scaling back of the ability for people with income greater than $250,000 to itemize deductions. It's being proposed that itemizing deductions for people above $250,000 income would be replaced with a credit. And then the last thing you may have heard about, and this continues to be discussed, is proposals in limiting both the top-end contribution limits for IRAs, as well as limiting the amount of years your heirs can stretch out those IRAs. Obviously, if you step back and think about it, almost all of these proposals deal with revenue, deal with the deficits we face. So again, we do not know of any legislation that's literally pending, or it is true that we are not about to see contribution limits, lifetime contribution limits put on retirement plans, or a limitation of stretch out for your beneficiaries, but that continues to be discussed as something that might be done to allow the IRS to get to our tax dollars more quickly. So the moral of this story is this: how should we wrap up? I think the things I have shared with you should most get the attention of those of you who are blessed to have an estate as a single person that is nearing the 5 million mark or well over that, or as a married couple nearing or will near in the future the 10 million mark or well over that. Please do not go to sleep on the need to do advanced planning and estate tax planning, because we're pretty confident if we meet a year or two or three or five into the future, some of the tools you would have available to you right now will be taken away from you. So if you have questions, we can return to that at the beginning. But I think right now, Aaron Kimsey is next, or someone may be standing in for Aaron today, to talk to us about dealing with states, not at the federal level, but states that have estate taxes and inheritance taxes.
Thanks, Jim. This is Aaron Kimsey. I'm a paralegal with the Anderson firm. I do some of the drafting on trusts, and as you can tell, I do research into state estate taxes and state inheritance taxes. These are I've got two topics to talk to you all about today. Both of them are topics that I try to procrastinate on with our death and taxes. I'm sure each of you all do the same. The starting point here is going to be kind of a definition of estate tax and a definition of inheritance tax. The estate tax is something, it's like the federal estate tax, which is levied against the total value of an estate, whereas an inheritance tax is levied against the individual that is actually inheriting the money. So let's say it would be 5%, a tax of 5% levied against the estate if it went to your brother, whereas maybe nothing if it went to your children. The states that have an estate tax are Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Jersey, New York, Oregon, Rhode Island, Tennessee, Vermont, Washington State, and Washington, D.C. The states that have an inheritance tax are Iowa, Kentucky, Maryland, Nebraska, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. You may have noticed that Maryland and New Jersey have both an estate tax and an inheritance tax. The reason that I call them procrastination taxes is because they're easily solved. Bill, Jolene, and Jim can help you pretty much get rid of either one of them in their entirety. And so the takeaways from state taxes and state inheritance taxes are that the state that you live in actually matters So give us a call and we can help you eliminate those taxes. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Bill, who's going to talk to you about asset protection and wealth preservation. Thanks.
Good. Thank you, Aaron. And Aaron is not only a paralegal, but in less than a year will be an attorney with us. He talked about how important the state was on where you live. So very true, because estate taxes and inheritance taxes have a state component. So we do work all over the country. Jim used an example of Florida. Florida has no state estate or state inheritance. But for those of us in New York, they have an estate tax for a state estate tax, and it works differently. So the way it works in New York is if you go 5% over the amount that is your credit, and today that's $2 million, it's going up to the federal level of $5.34 million by 2019. But if you just go 5% over, you go all the way back to $1 with a highest tax rate of 16%. So 16% on $10 million is $1.6 million. And so we can help you do that. Aaron Kimsey has put together for our firm a great chart if you want to see it. And he has every single state listed with what their estate tax is, their gift tax, their inheritance tax, and their income tax. And all you've got to do is let us know and we'll send one to you. And you don't let the tax tail wag the life dog. But if you're living in New Jersey or Connecticut or New York, but you also have a home in Scottsdale, Arizona, or in Palm Beach or wherever the case may be, then there are ways we can go about structuring that as your main home so you're not going to pay that extra 16% tax. Okay. Let me just say a couple of comments on asset protection. As I think everyone on this call would know, the only things we do, as I said in the beginning, was estate planning, estate settlement, estate litigation, asset protection, and elder law. And I want to focus on the asset protection piece. When I started practicing 30 years ago this past May, the American Bar Association did not even have a section on asset protection. It really wasn't a recognized practice. We now have the most litigious society in the history of the world. And I don't want this to be a history lesson, but the reason for this is a number of things, but after World War II, with the GI Bill, everybody was able to get an education, a college education. People were encouraged to go on and get degrees. There was money there to fund education. It is very, very inexpensive, whether it's at Harvard and Yale and Princeton, Vanderbilt, Emory, wherever it is, very inexpensive to educate a lawyer as compared to a physician or an engineer. You can put 100 kids in a classroom with one professor and one exam at the end of the year. Every single college wanted a law school. And so we have had this proliferation of lawyers, and there's the old story that if there's one lawyer in town, they don't do very well. Two, they're able to sue each other's clients and do okay. But three or more, and they all join the country club. And there is some truth to that. So it is so bad now that when the kids today take their law school admissions test, a big red box pops up on the screen talking to them about the low placement rates. I tell you this story in preface of talking briefly about asset protection because we have so many kids or young lawyers going out, not finding positions, hanging a shield, a sign out on the street and practicing on their own. looking for lawsuits to bring. And it's not just whether you win or lose, because we have a system where the loser does not have to pay the winner's cost, like in England. So the cost of the fees, attorney's fees alone. So there are three levels of asset protection. There is the level when you leave things to after husband and wife are gone, or if you're single, you alone, you leave them to the people you love. You should never, this is my important takeaway, never, ever, ever leave those assets outright. You should never leave them a third at 25, a third at 30, a third at 35. You should always leave them in trust. Now, you can make your child their own trustee and their own beneficiary, or if it's a minor, or if there's an alcohol or drug problem, you can have somebody else as a trustee. Or if they're a youngster, you can start off with somebody else as a trustee, and at age 35, they can be their own trustee. So the number one rule on leaving assets to children, grandchildren, people you love, is always leave it in trust. Let's go up a level. What about when your spouse passes away? Many people say, I leave everything to my spouse, and if not to my spouse, then to my children. So that is wrong for a number of reasons. There's some tax reasons for that, but there are major asset protection reasons. If you leave your asset, so I'll pick the guys first. We tend to go first. And so husband passes away, leaves it to wife in her individual name. It is not protected. It is not protected from creditors, from lawsuits, from predators, from divorcing spouses. You leave it to your spouse in trust. Your spouse can be their own trustee, their own beneficiary, have control on it, but bad people cannot get to it. Now, the third and the last piece that I want to mention on asset protection is what about when we are alive? You have to look at asset protection asset by asset. So let's take our home. In some states, we'll use Florida or Texas. They have incredible homestead laws, meaning that it's Texas and Kansas and Florida and Nevada. Basically, if you've lived in your home for X period of time, nobody's going to take it away from you. That's why O.J. Simpson moved to Florida when he got in trouble, because he was able to buy a big home and protect that home. The other states have nothing, or $45,000 of homestead protection. So you got to look at it state by state. Your IRA is protected. Your 401k has increased protection. In some states, insurance and annuities, I'll use Florida again, by Florida Supreme Court decision and by legislature, insurance and annuities are totally protected. That's not true in every state. So there we know we have certain assets. But let's talk about your taxable brokerage account. If it is in your individual name, it is not protected. It is not protected. If it is in joint names, it's only protected as long as you remain married and your spouse remains alive. And then it is unprotected. There are ways that we can go about protecting those assets. Asset protection is not about hiding assets. It is about putting it in entities that separate your enjoyment, which you need, and control, which you still get, from the actual technical ownership of it. So in our case, we use a specialized LLC out of Wyoming. It's called the Wyoming Close LLC. We would put your brokerage account and have done that for many of you in there. We might put investment real estate in the others. And all business law is state law. And so it really matters. So let me give you an example. I'll use three of the states we've already used today. In Florida, well, first of all, you would never use an S corporation. because if you get sued, they can take your S corporation or your C corporation stock. You would want to use an LLC in some states, but let's take Florida and New York to start off with. In Florida, a single member LLC has no asset protection at all. People are stunned to hear that. The Supreme Court and the Florida legislature said we're going to ignore asset protection if an LLC has only one member. So what about a New York LLC? A New York LLC, the statute is very, very clear. It says a judge can do whatever they want to with an LLC whose member has a judgment. They can instruct the LLC to pay the judgment. They can even dissolve the LLC and liquidate it so the assets are available for creditors. Other states, New Jersey just changed theirs in January to get more conservative and more helpful to debtors. We go to Wyoming because in Wyoming, they say, the only remedy is a charging order. In other words, if you don't make distributions, they're not getting anything. So my point of all of this is if you have justifiable paranoia, and by that I mean if you want to wake up tomorrow and make absolutely sure you've got a protective shield around your assets, that because bad things happen to good people, there are ways to do that, but it's better to do something earlier than to do nothing. So having said that, that is asset protection. Let me at that point turn it over to, I believe, Aaron Turner.
Hi, Bill. Thank you. I'm going to talk a little bit about making sure that your estate plan is updated, and that's one of the reasons that we hold these annual client conference calls, is to give folks the opportunity to think about their estate planning documents. I know most of us don't go around every day thinking about our estate planning documents, but it is important to at least consider and try to remember what we've done periodically. So making sure your estate plan is reviewed and up to date is almost as important as actually doing the plan in the first place. There are changes in the law, there's changes in your life which may necessitate a need for revision to the documents. We stay on top of the tax law changes, which Jim covered, and we make ourselves available to you for any changes that you have in your life. Bill mentioned earlier that we're focused on long-term relationships with our clients, and so if you have any changes, pick up the phone and call. We're here to help. Now I'm going to turn it over to Jerry Sureski, who's going to talk about dealing with second homes in other states. Jerry?
Yes, thanks, Aaron. Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Sureski. Today I want to talk to you about certain things you have to keep in mind when you own real estate in states other than where you live, and how that can have some adverse effect on your estate plan if those properties are not titled correctly. The first thing you keep in mind is that it's important that you don't have those properties, regardless of where they are, in your individual name. As you know, anything that is in your individual name at the time of your death has got to go through probate. One of the main reasons we prepare a trust for you is to hold these real properties so that they don't go through probate. This is particularly important when you have property in other states because this may cause a probate in your home, and meaning your home state and the state where you have the other property. You can have a probate in both states. And you can prevent this situation if you title the homes in something other than your individual name. Any other type of ownership that tells how the property passes at your death avoids probate. Now, there's some alternatives to putting the homes in a revocable living trust. If the home is an investment, like a rental home, if you want to consider, you may want to consider a limited liability company, an LLC, and retitle that home into that LLC. preferentially a Wyoming LLC for asset protection. And this not only prevents probate in both states, but also protects your assets from creditors. And it will probably discount the value of the property for the purposes of calculating your estate taxes. Now, again, it's important to note that only investment properties should go into a limited liability company. You cannot put personal use homes. Personal use homes can also be titled into QPERTs. QPERTs is short for Qualified Personal Residence Trust. And this is a type of trust that holds personal residence and significantly saves you estate taxes. We usually coordinate with a person in the other state who prepares the deed to make sure that the new deed is exactly, the title is exactly as it should be. So if this situation applies to you and you will be transferring some properties into either a trust or a company, when you get a person in those states preparing that deed for you, you can tell them to give us a call, and we're going to give this person the title to the new property, how it should read, to make sure that it's exactly right. Okay, so that's all I have on this, and with that, I will turn it to Rhonda.
All right, thanks, Jerry, and thank you to all the presenters for all that useful information today. We are now ready to begin our question and answer session, but before we do so, if you'll bear with me just one moment, I'm going to end our recording.